The Big Wake Up by Mark Coggins is what you hope every private eye novel will be, says Edgar Award-winning author Megan Abbott. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 14, Go Ahead and Cry. I made a quick stop at the local hardware store for a product from the adhesive aisle before pointing the Escalade towards Maximo's house, which, as it happened, was barely 2 miles away.
"What's with the pizza sign and the stuff from the Manly Man store?"
asked Chris from the passenger seat once we got rolling. "For later," I said. "A better question is, how did you meet up with this Zigar character?"
"I dated his younger, hipper, gayer brother, is how."
"I read somewhere that younger brothers are more likely to be gay. Something about successive male pregnancies changing the environment in the womb."
"That's right. Kind of like an opera singer clearing her throat before she sings the aria, the fabulous aria."
"Did you just equate heterosexual males to post-nasal drip?" Chris didn't say anything. When I looked over at him, he made a zip my lips gesture. We motored up Castro Street towards Valley. Maximo lived on the final block of the street, a stubby narrow section which dead-ended into the hillside below Diamond. My idea had been to attach the tracker to Maximo's car if he was there, and if he wasn't, to stake out his house until he showed. If all else failed, I was prepared to tail him the old-fashioned way. There was no Porsche in the driveway or in the street near the tiny stucco bungalow, but I could see that the thought of parking the easy-to-spot Escalade anywhere on the block was a non-starter. Maximo would see it the moment he pulled up. After some consultation, Chris and I agreed the best course of action was to circle up to Diamond, where we would have a bird's-eye view of the street below. A set of stairs went from Diamond to the cul-de-sac at the end of Valley, and we hoped to be able to sneak down those to get at Maximo's car, if and when he made an appearance. As a sort of dry run, I sent Chris down them as soon as we parked. Maximo's house had a one-car garage, and I was worried that he might be at home with a Porsche hidden inside. I told Chris to ring the doorbell and pretend to be soliciting if he answered. Chris reappeared at the top of the stairs about 10 minutes later and heaved himself into the passenger seat.
"All clear,"
he said as he pulled the door shut. I saw. What were you going to ask for if he came to the door?
"A donation to the Chris Duckworth Welfare League."
"That's altruistic."
"There is no I in self-centered."
We settled into wait. It appeared that neither Valley Street nor this section of Diamond had a great deal of traffic. In the first hour or so, the only things stirring were an athletic mom jogging behind one of those triathlon-ready baby strollers, and an artsy-fartsy-looking guy in a black turtleneck taking close-up pictures of weeds and knotholes with a digital camera. Chris chafed under my all-jazz, all-the-time radio tyranny, and insisted on substituting one of the Broadway musical CDs from his messenger bag, a chorus line. I stood about 3 minutes before I made him switch. He replaced the disc with, of all things, the original cast recording from Evita. "Mood music to watch Argentinians by," I said. "But you're such a Madonna fan. Why not go with a movie soundtrack?"
"As much as I like the Material Girl, Patti LuPone's got her beat all to hell."
Somewhere in the midst of Miss LuPone singing about how she wanted to be part of BA, Buenos Aires, I realized I hadn't told Chris much of anything about the case, and I felt I owed it to him. I gave him the full rundown, right from Rivero hiring me through to my leaving Melina at the hotel.
"So you got Melina to spend the night even after Isis came and tied you up?"
he said at the end.
"Your luck with the ladies has definitely changed."
"Chris, you're missing the point. This is serious stuff. You don't have to hang with me if you don't want to."
I get it. But Mad Max here doesn't sound too dangerous, as long as you stay away from his knees. Besides, who's going to plant the tracker or work the software on the computer? Not you, that's for sure.
We had already agreed he would plant the tracker since Maximo wouldn't recognize him, and he had a point about the computer. Okay, I said, but be careful and just know you're free to quit any time if we run into any of these other characters. Chris nodded solemnly and then spoiled it by breaking into a shit-eating grin. He started jabbering on again about how great Lupone was and how she had recently won a second Tony Award. And then, just as she was launching into the famous showstopper tune about not crying for Argentina, things got interesting. Chris was the first to spot it. He nudged my elbow and pointed out the driver's window.
You said this Max guy drives a Porsche, right?
I looked down Valley Street and saw Maximo's pearl gray Porsche come tearing through the intersection at Castro. He skidded into his driveway and threw open the door. He strode up to the house, and after fiddling impatiently with the lock, pulled his way inside, leaving the front door standing wide open. That's him, all right. You better get down. Chris had grabbed the tracker and jumped out the moment I confirmed it was Maximo. I stepped out of the car, too, and stood behind a tree at the top of the stairs to get a better look. I also pulled my Glock from its shoulder holster, just in case. Chris flew down the stairs to Valley Street, jogged up the road, and then broke into an almost comical, nonchalant walk as he approached the house. He paused by the driveway, bent down to tie his shoe, and then half slithered, half crawled over to the rear wheel of the car. His hand darted underneath the well, and then he scampered back to the street, where he did a sort of rapid goose step towards the stairs. Maximo appeared at the door of the house carrying a hose and a bucket that looked like it was filled with cleaning supplies. He clicked a key fob to open the Porsche's front trunk, dumped all the stuff inside, and injected himself into the low-slung car. I heard the starter grind, and almost immediately the back tires chirped as he reversed out of the drive. He shoved it into first and rocketed down the street, biting down hard on a right turn at Castro and disappearing from view. I was reholstering the Glock when Chris crested the stairs, triumphant in his accomplishment.
Come on, to the Batmobile.
We climbed into the Escalade and I got it rolling while Chris booted his laptop and brought up the tracking software.
Hey,
he said.
It's working.
I looked over at him. You mean there was any doubt?
Zig plays Dungeons and Dragons. Who knows where the fantasy ends and the reality begins?
He pointed down to the screen.
Mad Max took 29th down to Sanchez and then hung a left. He turned right on Cesar Chavez and now the software says he's going 50 miles per hour. Better hustle.
I followed Maximo's route to the letter, but kept to his safe and sane speed. I figured I would know where he was going soon enough, and besides, the whole point of the tracker was being able to follow from a distance. As we got ourselves onto Cesar Chavez, Chris sang out,
He's getting close to the 101 entrance. Nope, he passed it by. He's still on Chavez.
Then a minute later,
He passed 280 as well. Looks like he's going to China Basin. Yep, he just made a right on 3rd.
China Basin is an industrial area near the docks that was filled with warehouses, grain elevators, abandoned shipyards, and the odd homeless encampment. It wasn't exactly my idea of a salubrious environment, especially after dark. We followed Maximo all the way down Cesar Chavez and then took a right onto 3rd, as he had done. By that point, Chris had identified an address on Cargo Way where he had stopped. I took a left onto Cargo as directed, and we spotted Maximo's car parked outside the door of a white, bunker-like warehouse with a wide orange stripe painted just below the roofline. A panel van was parked beside the Porsche, and a sign identified the building as belonging to a company with Maximo's surname, Velas Importers. Maximo himself wasn't visible, but I decided I was done pussyfooting around, so I stopped in plain sight about 10 yards away and cut the motor. I looked over at Chris. You were wondering about the dome light from the pizza parlor? I grabbed the light and the quick-drying adhesive I'd got at the hardware store and walked over to the Porsche. The light had suction cups on the bottom of it so it could be removed, but the adhesive fixed that. I glued it smack dab in the middle of the roof and then stood back to admire my handiwork. Given the way Maximo had waxed poetic about the car in his notes to Araceli, I felt certain he wouldn't appreciate it being turned into a pizza delivery wagon.
"You're a cruel man,"
said Chris as I returned to the Escalade. "A knee to the groin can do that to you. Now we wait. It's too bad we don't have the Candid Camera crew with us."
"The punked crew. You need to keep up with your cultural references."
"Whatever. If there had been a camera crew waiting, they wouldn't have filmed the show I was expecting. When Maximo came out of the warehouse, it was clear that something was wrong. He looked stressed and agitated, even before he saw the dome light. When he did, he grabbed at it and attempted to yank it off. The glue held, causing him to curse and pound the roof of the car. But then he gave up and started for the driver's side door. I jumped out of the Escalade with my Glock drawn and shouted at him, "Hey, Maxi, how about getting me a pepperoni with extra cheese?" Maximo whirled to look at me, and I saw that there were tears streaming down his face. He held my gaze for a moment, and then turned right back and reached for the door. "Wait," I shouted. "Hold it right there. I want to talk to you." Words, and even the gun, made no impression. He yanked the door open, threw himself inside, and fired up the engine. There was an instant where I could have taken a clean shot at him or the car, but it would have been foolhardy. The Porsche kicked up gravel as he reversed out of the lot, and then he fishtailed down Cargo Way, a cloud of burnt rubber and exhaust wafting slowly after him. Chris ran up to stand beside me.
"What was that all about?"
he asked. "Damned if I know." I was still watching Maximo's receding car when I felt Chris tug at my sleeve.
"August, look."
I turned back to the building. There was a stencil of bloody footprints by the door and the place the car had been parked. Maximo's footprints. "Go back to the car," I said.
"No way, I'm coming with."
"Then stay behind me and don't step in the blood." We navigated our way around the footprints and up to the door, and I pulled out a handkerchief to use on the knob. It was unlocked. I pushed the door open with my foot and ducked to the side. When no bullets came flying, I peeked around the frame. Inside was a vast concrete pad with no partitioning. The concrete walls were painted a much scuffed white, and the ceiling had the ductwork and framing exposed. Light came from dusty fluorescent tubes that hummed with a noise like a sick headache. The only things on the floor were a table with a dirty coffin on top and a pair of wheeled hoists like you might use to lift and transport an engine or a coffin. Just then, the hoists were not being used to lift either of those things. The chain at the top of one dangled empty. The chain at the top of the other was wrapped around a man's ankles. A wide, irregular pool of blood spread from a place on the floor below his head. I thought I recognized him as Maximo's twin from the vital statistics office, but I couldn't be sure. I couldn't be sure because his face, gut, and places even lower or higher, given that he was hanging upside down, had been carved on by someone with a sharp knife. A sharp knife, and what I took to be an inoculation spoon. I drew a ragged breath and fought to keep from throwing up.
"What is it?"
whispered Chris, who was laminated against the exterior wall on the other side of the warehouse door. "Nothing that can hurt us," I said. "But nothing you want to see, either."
"What are you going to do?"
"I'm going in."
Then I'm going with you.
I really don't think you should, Chris. Someone's been hoisted up like a side of beef and cut with a knife. Chris made a kind of slobbering gulp.
Why are you going in?
There's also a coffin. Probably the one that was buried at Cypress Lawn. I have to see what this is all about.
I'll wait in the car.
Good call. I watched as he picked his way back to the Escalade, then straightened up to my full height and stepped through the door with a false boldness. I kept my eyes focused on the concrete pad, staying out of the blood and navigating from memory towards the coffin and away from the hoist. I came to a leg of the table and looked slowly up. The coffin on the tabletop was made of a shiny powder blue metal that peeped through the caked-on soil, bits of root, and other muck. The coffin was closed now, but it was clear it had been opened after it came out of the ground because the dirt and debris around the seal was disturbed. I holstered the Glock and drifted to the center of the table and put my hands on the edge of the encrusted lid. Now was not the time to think of my great aunt and my fear of embalmed bodies. Now was the time to recognize that that phobia was nothing compared to the dead man hanging by his ankles in the hoist. I put it all out of my mind and heaved upwards. A half section of the coffin lifted open, and I found myself looking at the face, chest, and torso of a perfectly preserved woman. So perfectly preserved that if it weren't for the fact her eyes were closed, her hands were crossed over her chest, and I'd found her inside a dirty box I knew had been buried for more than 30 years, I would have taken her for a living person. She looked young, perhaps in her early 30s as Maria was supposed to be, and was pretty without being beautiful. Her hair was copper blonde, and it was pulled into a tight chignon behind her head. She was dressed in a light blue suit that was smartly tailored, and she held a golden rosary in her hands. I was leaning down to get a closer look at the signet ring on her finger when I heard an intake of breath. I just about fell in on top of her. I spun around to find Chris walking towards me with one hand pressed to the side of his head like a blinder, blocking his view of the tortured man. "I thought you were going to stay in the car," I hissed. Chris's lips trembled.
"I couldn't. I was worried about you, and I was scared to be alone, and..."
"And what?"
"I was curious."
"Well, get the fuck over here and satisfy your curiosity, because we're leaving. We can't afford to be found here. Maximo may have already called the cops." Chris shuffled forward, steering a wide path to the far corner of the table.
"Is there really a body inside?"
"Yes, there is, but it's not like any body you'd expect." He paused about 3 feet away, afraid to come closer.
"What do you mean?"
"She's perfect. She looks like she's still alive."
"Really?"
He stepped forward and peered over the edge. He dropped his hand from the side of his face.
"Oh my God, I get it now."
"What? What do you get?"
"I know who it is."
"Who already?"
"That's Evita Perón."
You have been listening to The Big Wake Up, a book Publishers Weekly described as outstanding in a starred review. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.